ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
The island of Sri Lanka sits on the Indian Ocean. And for centuries, Sri Lanka was at the centre of the maritime silk roads, the trade routes that looped around from East Africa through Arabia, Persia, India, the Spice Islands, and southern China. And this is why Sri Lankan food is such a glorious blend of intense flavours and influences from all over the world. Sean Christie David's family migrated from Sri Lanka to Australia in the 1980s, and Sean grew up with this food. And in 2019, Sean set up Colombo Social, a restaurant that gives jobs to people seeking asylum and serves food straight from his mum's cookbook. But starting this restaurant involved taking a sharp turn in life for Sean, who'd graduated from Sydney's western suburbs into the highly charged, highly paid world of finance, a world of money and Maseratis. It was a trip to Sri Lanka that utterly changed his outlook and ambitions. Hello, Sean.
Hello, Richard. How are you?
I'm well, sir. When I'm under the weather, though, I have a certain kinds of comfort foods I go to. Do you have a Sri Lankan dish that's a comfort food for you go to when you're not feeling like 100%, slightly ill or a bit sad and all that sort of thing?
My mum's chicken biryani. It's got everything you'd want. It's got flavour. It's got spice. It's a slow-cooked chicken that your mum would marinate for a long time and then layer it with rice ghee, because you can't go wrong with clarified butter, and fried onions. And then you get this fresh coriander and an amazing side of like coconut yogurt and cucumber, like a writer. I remember stepping off the plane after being in the UK for 2 years, going home and demolishing three massive plates at 8:30 in the morning. I was like, you're right. I'm like, I haven't had this for a long time. It just reminds me of that kitchen table and watching mum cook it for hours. It's an amazing dish.
Yeah, tell me about that experience. What pictures you have in your head of your mum making this amazing food when you were a kid?
I think it was only later in life that I realised the privilege that I had to watch that. Mum is just a home cook, but really refined. And I know that when she got to Australia, she would open up the Women's Weekly and get dishes from that and then put a Sri Lankan twist on it. So like we were having fusion food before fusion food was cool. But it was those flavours, those influences and watching her produce magic with not a lot. That was the joy of watching mum cook. It was a beautiful, beautiful thing to do with her.
And the aromatic kitchen. That's another thing too, surely, isn't it?
Yeah, there's so much. Like when we temper our spices, which is the core of all Sri Lankan cooking, you pop mustard seed, you then fry onion and fry garlic, and it just like builds to this level of all these different smells and things. Not great when you're going out on a date right after or something like that when mum's cooking, but it sticks to you, but it's really beautiful.
Tell me about some of the influences traditionally that have played into Sri Lankan cooking, because it's a bit like Nonya food, isn't it? It's a great kind of meeting place for where a culture has gone, we'll have a bit of that and a bit of that and a bit of that and experiment and see how it works.
It is. It's got so many different multicultural influences in it. So it's got the Chinese, the Dutch and the Portuguese. So we've got a thing called beef s'more, which is like just a roast beef, but then we chuck curry powder on it and cook it.
What's better than roast beef?
roast beef with curry powder
on top of it.
Yeah, exactly. then we've got the Dutch, the English, the Indian. I think there was a fair bit of Arabic influence in there as well. So a melting pot, to pardon the pun, of so many different cultures and flavours.
Yeah. Now, one of your mum's dishes at Christmas time was 48-hour mud crab curry. My God, 48 hours? How does that work? Tell me about this dish.
Yeah, it's a process. I'm not allowed to tell the recipe because I won't be alive tomorrow.
Right, it's a state secret, is it?
Exactly.
It's buried in a vault half a mile under the ground.
Yeah.
Right.
So we'd go to Cabramatta. My dad would go to Cabramatta. He'd go pick up live mud crabs. It was generally before Christmas. It was the only time that you could afford to spend like that much money on a lunch. Dad would come home and cut it and clean it, and then my mum would be starting the process. So you get like fresh coconut and then roast it and roast it and roast it till like it's black. And then you're adding tamarind and like 13 to 15 different spices that we've roasted on a hot flame, putting it all together, layering it, letting it sit, then making another sauce we call gravy, putting that in there,
layering that, letting that sit and marinate, cutting the crabs open, letting the juices go into the crab, and then re-cooking that the next day for a long time in a slow boil. It's a days-long process. Yeah, I think it takes about 2 to 3 days. But what you're getting is you're getting all those things into the crab itself. So you're breaking the shells open and putting it in there. And also getting this thick kind of sauce around it that I reckon would probably melt a car if you put it on there. It's that spicy. You're not allowed to bring someone that you don't know for at least 5 years to lunch because you're dripping in sweat, your nose is pouring, and there's just like black shit everywhere all over you. It's an experience.
You grew up in the western suburb of Sydney. What part of Sydney are we talking about here?
Yeah, so born in Campsie, and then we moved to Fairfield West and then to a little area called Denzer Park, which is kind of Bonnyrigg area, right? The next suburb there. Beautiful area. But yeah, the West was interesting.
Interesting. What brought your parents to Australia? Was it the Civil War in Sri Lanka?
It was a combination of things. So my parents were actually in Saudi Arabia for a long time, and they had wanted a better life for us. And it was the choice of going to Sri Lanka. And at that point, Sri Lanka was in starting the war at that stage. It kicked off. And it just didn't seem like the right area. And then my auntie, actually, bless her soul, really lovely lady, she was in Australia. And the way that she described it was like, it is just something that you have to experience. And if you wanted to build the life for your children versus them going and being part of, like, we're Tamil, wasn't going to be a good life for us. So, you know, my dad was highly skilled and was able to kind of get out here during those times. And we're lucky that we came here. I think about the life that we would have had if not for my aunt, literally, I would imagine, like, pretty much saving our lives, right?
Yeah, but it must have been wrenching. For Civil War or no Civil War,
yep.
Sri Lanka is famously like an earthly paradise. I mean, all the medieval accounts call it the island of Serendip. It's where we get the word serendipity from.
Yep.
Rubies and diamonds were said to roll down from the mountain. The food was in abundance. Does a memory of it haunt your parents, I wonder?
My dad's never gone back. My dad can never go back. He remembers those days. He remembers, like, because my dad would actually be a mechanic and he got to travel around the whole of Sri Lanka jungles and go to the east when the east was like this untouched paradise, and the north and things like that. And like, why won't you ever go back? He's like, why would I? Like, you don't understand what I know about the country and what it is now. I don't want to ruin those memories. And
oh,
I think
it's a lost paradise then.
It's just not the same as what it could have been. It was a country that could have been. And I look at the way that, like, it's beautiful still now and it's great. But I think in my dad's eyes, it will never be the same. And my mum goes back a little bit. But I think that their memories of what Sri Lanka was and is today is at loggerheads for what they want to have their memories. And I kind of get that.
You mentioned your dad was a mechanic. Did he find work as a mechanic in Sydney when he arrived there?
Yes and no. He had to get recertified. I just remember my dad's a very intelligent man, and he had to go back to TAFE after doing, like, he was the head of, like, this huge mechanical plant in Saudi Arabia working for the American government over there or something. I don't know what he was doing. He was very qualified, and he got to Australia. He got here and they're like, oh, you got to go to TAFE. He's like, why? Like, I've got 20 plus years of experience in this, and now it's not recognized here. And he ends up teaching the TAFE course because the TAFE teacher doesn't know what he's doing. He's like, mate, like, I'll show you. And that's that kind of just really hits me about, like, people and their skills not being recognized, their transferable knowledge, and how much we as this nation are losing, how much insights, how many valuable people we're not giving their credit to, and that lost opportunity.
Up in a family of three boys. You're the youngest, I think. Is that right?
Yeah, the youngest.
Yeah, you're tall and powerfully built. Is there anything left of the home you grew up in? I mean, because you're wrestling all the time, I'm imagining. Is that what was going on? I mean, three boys.
Three boys.
Yeah.
I'm the smallest off the lot, actually. My brother's a big unit. But yeah, look, what would happen was we had a rumpus room.
Yeah, so there was rumpus in the rumpus room.
The rumpus room.
Yeah.
And we had this WWE belt. My brother created a belt, a world WWF at the time, a WWF gold belt. And we had these two couches, and my brothers would jump off from the couch, smash each other on the head, and we would wrestle for like 40 minutes. But my mum was downstairs, and somehow she, like, I think now she would have known that we were doing it. But when she'd walk upstairs, when it got really loud and really like someone was crying, I reckon, she'd come up and we'd run into our rooms pretending to be studying while we're sweating and probably our eyes were open and with blood and stuff. So yeah, it was a wild house, but it was all love.
Did you get to wear the belt?
I was tiny. I was 6 years younger than my biggest brother. I think they let me win a couple of times out of like pity, but no, I never was that good.
So you're in the Bonnie Rigg area.
Yeah.
What was your high school like in beautiful Bonnie Rigg, the local high school?
My middle brother lasted a week there. He went for a week and they blew up the toilets and he's like, probably not for us. And then
you mean students blew up the toilets?
Yeah. It was an interesting school. But I knew that if I go to school like my local high school that I would get into trouble. I knew that the influences that might be there might not be where I want to go. So I worked really hard. I worked to not be there. I remember my mum was very honest with me as a, like 11-year-old kid. Like, hey, look, we probably can't afford private school, but if you want to make something of your life, you know, do something. She encouraged me. She supported me, and I repaid that by working really hard. And yeah, I remember waking up five o'clock in the morning. Starting to get into selective school, which was like, thankfully I got in there. I don't know where I'd be if I didn't, but yeah, it was luck. It was luck as well.
What was the environment like at the selective school? This would be Hillstone Agricultural College, wasn't it?
Yeah, Hillstone Agricultural. Yeah.
And what was the environment like? How different was it to your previous educational environment?
We had people going to Maths Olympics. They would go to the Olympics for mathematics. There was this dude, I remember being like year 12 and this year 7 student was in a 4-unit maths class. I'm like, hey man, I don't know what I'm doing. You're 11, 12. What are you doing in here? I was killing it. So a place where you like celebrated academia and celebrated like it wasn't, you know, you go to most schools and it's like, it's not cool to be smart. I remember talking to some like very intelligent people, who didn't have that supportive environment, and they dumbed themselves down. And I'm like, oh, you're so brilliant. And I think it was just lucky that like we were able to be in an environment that supported each other. We lifted each other up, and academically we did that. And I think that was nice. It was nice to be able to go, okay, well, I want to do something with my life, and I want to do that. And all my friends from school are doing incredible things, and yeah, super lucky.
So it was a relief because you didn't have to pretend to be someone you weren't anymore.
That's right, and I think that's really carried through as an adult now. And again, I am who I am. I'm unashamedly myself. That might not be everybody's cup of tea, but I've just learned to be comfortable. And like, you know, when you're in school and we dressed like Steve Irwin, we had a Steve Irwin outfit, like uniform. It was like khaki shorts, khaki shirt, and like long khaki socks. I'm like, what? A brown dude like dressed up like Steve Irwin. It was like a bit of a satire, I reckon. We just were who we were, and it was okay. It was okay to be that. It was okay to not probably fit in the conventional world, but like Australian born, Sri Lankan heritage. Where do I fit in the world? What am I? Who am I? And those kind of things was really, at a young age, it was hard to kind of navigate. And as an adult, still grapple with it. Still grapple with survivor's guilt and the intergenerational trauma. Still grapple with what could have been.
Did it allow you to be gentle?
I was angry. I was angry a lot. Growing up, I was angry a lot as an adult. I still kind of have anger. At the injustice of the world sometimes. I do feel that. But it allowed me to have empathy, a deep sense of empathy and understanding and recognition of people and where they are in their lives. I think that's what it's been able to allow me to do.
Tell me about the day you went in with your brother and your mum for your brother's, older brother's first proper job interview. Into the CBD of Sydney, the forest of skyscrapers, a world away from the outer western suburbs of Bonnie Rigg.
Yeah, exactly. So we get into the city. My brother, bless his soul, is wearing a dark green suit.
Right.
And a Bugs Bunny tie. And then, like, all right, so where my mum is...
Sorry, are you serious? He was wearing a Bugs Bunny tie?
Yeah. 100%. It's right. So funny. And then my Mum didn't know anything about Australian like jobs. Like my dad was a tradie, right? Like my mum didn't know about corporate Australia. We knew nothing about this stuff.
So my mom actually goes into the job interview with him. He's very
into the room.
Into the room. Oh,
that's,
yeah,
that's really lovely.
Yeah,
I wish so, we were all allowed to bring our mums along for our first job interview. So this is my mother. You know why she's here as a kind of support person for this. That's lovely.
Yeah, probably have better jobs if I took my mum. She'll probably get the job.
What effect did it have on you to walk into into that part of the world?
So I'd never seen the power. I'd never seen the suit. I'd never seen. And my brother was wearing a suit. You know, like I'm like, oh, maybe it's possible. But I walked in. It smelled like money. It smelt like success. It smelt different. The air just smelled different. The whole scene just felt different. It felt like watching a movie. You know, I was in this movie. I was a character in this movie, watching people walk quickly with purpose, going somewhere. Like, these guys are successful, and I went, I want to be that. I want to be that guy. I want to have success. I want to have money, and it sparked something in me that led me to my career, but. It was a different world, like that modern place city back in, like, I would be saying, like, the early 90s, right? It was fascinating world.
And what did you think it could do for you, apart from make you rich? Was there an allure of power with that?
Yeah, 100%. These guys walked with purpose, and they walked, their backs were straight. Their hands were clean. I at that stage, we only knew tradies. You know, my dad was a mechanic. All his mates were great, lovely guys, but they all had, I looked at my dad's hands. My dad's hands were, you know, he had a truck fall in his hand. He had, you know, like calluses and rough hands. And he always said, I don't want this life for you. I don't want you to work as hard as I do. It was just a different world. And I saw a different type of work. Like, we had only known slog. I always think about my dad. I'd go on the road with him during school holidays, and I'd get to sit in the van, and the van had oil everywhere, and you kind of get out and you smell like engine oil, and you'd walk out and it'd be 40 degrees, or it'd be, you know, pissing down rain and thunder. My dad still had to work. He didn't have sick days. He didn't have like wet weather days. He didn't have all that kind of stuff. And he would work. He would work in those circumstances. And these guys, they had an office. They had like shelter. I'm like, wow, that's an incredible place to be.
So where did you go out of, once you finished school, where did you go to study?
I went to UTS, just around the corner.
Yeah.
I studied a Bachelor of Business with a finance, banking and financial planning major. And I lasted 6 months as a full-time student because there was a bar at uni. And there was me. I remember after 6 months, my mate's like, "Hey, man, I'm changing courses because like I can't do any classes with you anymore." And like three people are like, "Yeah, we're doing the same." I'm like, "Oh, this is a sign, isn't it?"
People were socially detaching from you because you were a bad influence. Is that what you're saying?
That's what I told you. I couldn't go to Bunnery.
So like skip the chute and go to the bar and have a beer. That kind of thing.
That was it. That was you. Yeah, right. It was. Like, I mean, what were they thinking? Like, unlimited alcohol, like $3.50 for like 18-year-old kids. So yeah, I did, and then I just realized that, look, like, this isn't good. This isn't good for me. It's not good for my mates either. So I dropped to part time uni, doing uni at nights, and yeah, I started working.
And what was your first job in the financial world?
It was reconciliations something officer. Something, I don't know what the official title was, at the Royal Bank of Canada.
Does that mean incomings has got to match outgoings or something?
Something
ledger's got to match with what's in the till, effectively?
I remember that. I remember my first day, and I get in there and this lady's like, "Oh, printed out all these pieces of paper." And she prints off pieces of paper and then prints off another piece of paper and then manually starts ticking this stuff. I'm like, you know, you can like do that. Like, you can just do that on the computer. Because we're doing this manually, like, it with no rhyme or reason, no order. I'm like, why don't you just sort it and then, like, match it? And it was kind of constant, like, no, that's not how it's done. I'm like, but it's really easy. Let me show you. She's like, no, that's not how it's done. And from that point, I realized that, okay, cool, I will challenge, like, the normality. I won't accept this is how it's always been done, so we just do it that way. And I was a little shit, and I think they hated me. But
yeah, but yeah. Your bosses would have liked it, I expect, given you're a digital guy in a no longer analog world.
Yeah, I mean, this was the 2000s, I think.
Right.
2005, we were printing stuff. So yeah, I did go on to say, hey, look, there's a better way to do this. And they liked it, but it was, yeah. So I think we saved, like, I remember, like, hours a day. I think it was like 6 hours a day.
at the age of 18. And yeah, it was eventually people came around to it. But yeah, it was interesting.
So you went from there to a major financial services corporation,
yeah.
The world of kind of high finance. I know a little bit about that world. I've never been in it, of course, yep. but I know everyone in that world, well, most of the people in that world, those traders anyway, they work 16-hour days,
yep.
They drive Maseratis, yep. And they are on their third marriages.
Yep.
They've told themselves at a young age that money is absolutely everything in the world,
yep.
And it's quite a cynical story, I suppose, they tell themselves, and then gradually, of course, they realise the world isn't really like that.
Yep.
How did you fit in with that world, Sean? What did you think of that world? And did you? I mean, it sounds like the world you wanted all along, but was it?
When I got there, I realised it wasn't what I wanted. I thought money would be an escape. I thought money would be I've made it. I've overcome, or money would be a telltale of, you know, what people would look at you and go, oh, you've got money, like, and it's just not. It's money's a necessary evil. My mum would always say that, like, money's a necessary evil, but don't chase it. You know, and I look back now, and if I could give people advice, it would be chase a feeling, chase what you want, chase what makes you happy. There's an internal driver that will be satisfying, and that isn't a cash-filled hole. It's no amount of money would do that. When I got there and I saw people chasing a promotion or chasing something, I would think. And I remember talking to my brother, who's a lot older than me. I'm like, man, like, when is it enough? Because, like, okay, I'm on $100,000. When I get to $150,000, I'll be happy. When I get to $150,000, that target's going to move. And when do you become satisfied? When do you go, this is enough? When do you stop? And when do you do it? Because you're always chasing something. And with a moving goalpost, or with something that isn't necessarily going to have an end in it. Like, you know, I was reading an article about a trade the other day, and the guy was like, my bonus was tied to this, and then they would give it to me then, and then you just couldn't get out of it. We tie success to what car you drive. We tie success to what, you know, what house you live in and the suburb you are in and this and that. And there's such a deep linkage between what you have to how happy you must be. And I've met some of the most unhappy people in my lives who are the most richest, the most successful in the eyes of the world, but deeply unhappy. And I look at my mum, and she believes in humility. She believes in, like, being content. And my mum's a very content person. And she was a childcare teacher. I always remember this. She was a childcare teacher. And, you know, they don't earn a lot of money, but he'd come home at, like, that graduation ceremony, and we had a dining table that would fit six people, and then you could it was one of those old school ones where you could extend it. You know, you pull the things out and you can extend it. It becomes an 8-seater table, and we had to extend it, and then we had to put things on the kitchen table as well, because she would bring home that many gifts from the parents. And she'd bring home that many thank you cards, and she was happy. She had hugs from students. She had thank you notes. She had people saying, you've made a difference in my child's life. You've done something. She left, I think, 10 years ago, 15 years ago, right? But she walks down the shops, and I walk down the shops with her, and people say, hey, Miss Shirani, I'm in a selective school now. Or, hey, Miss Shirani, she told me the other day, a kid was the ducks of their school in primary school. And they're like, we thank you for that. It was because of the way that you treated him when he was 4 years old. I'm like, that is success, and that you might never know it, you may never feel it, but you've done something that is a legacy, right?
Podcast and broadcast. This is Conversations with Richard Feidler. Find more Conversations anytime on the ABC Listen app.
When you were working for that major financial institution space, you'd be working with a lot of guys called Angus and Fergus who come from private schools. How did they make you feel? Did they make you feel welcome? Did you even care about that?
I wasn't like them. I didn't fit in. They kind of let me know that. I didn't go to private school and I didn't have like dads who went to school together with each other and the long-standing history and friendships. I didn't fit in. And I remember one day I was there and, you know, like I was a Sri Lankan, probably the only Sri Lankan. And one guy's like, hey, like nickname, funny nickname. Great, you can get a nickname. You've graduated to nicknames. Tamil Tiger. I'm like, whoa, man, like pretty brutal, pretty bad nickname. They're a terrorist organization and you know, they're hurting people, including my family. And that was just fuel to that fire. They loved it. And I look back, I'm like, no one cared? While I don't think that they're intrinsically bad people, I think that it was back then, it was a bit of a different culture. And the world's changed dramatically. The banking world's changed, the diversity and inclusion. There's Sri Lankan female CEOs of large financial institutions and it's changed. But back then, that was seen as funny.
It's also bad for business. And if you're going around calling colleagues a Tamil Tiger, rather foolishly, you're going to cost the company money at the end of the day. Then.
Yeah, exactly. And I don't know how I'd feel about it if it happened today. Do you know, I was so young. I didn't have a voice. I didn't have the confidence that I have now. And I suppose what fuels me every day, and I'm a very introverted, shy person. I don't like to talk about what I do. And if, you know, sometimes I come to a point where I don't tell people a lot of the work that we do because I like to keep it pretty close to myself and it's very nice for me to feel, but no one knows half of what we do out there in the world. And I remember talking to my brother about this and he said, it's not about you, man. It's not about you anymore. Don't take that ego. It's about making sure that the people that look like us that didn't get access to the rooms that we get access to, that didn't have the voice, can have a voice. And I think if I knew that I could have a voice back then, would it be different? Probably I would have spoken up, but I didn't. I felt the sea of them and the one of me means that I couldn't be there. So I think, you know, you say, I'm a big dude, man. I'm 6'3". And I now have ability to talk to lots of people. And the reason why I say things is not to like cause problems or to do anything. I just want to make sure that people see each other and see people and see their inner being, I think. Yeah.
You said that a moment that changed your perspective and all this.
Yeah.
You're saying just before that was from a trip to Sri Lanka. What happened on that trip?
We didn't go back for 23 years for multiple reasons, probably safety being the ultimate one. And when the war finished, I was 28 years old. I was working at a large bank at the time. Went back and my mum had always said to me, are you 5, you're 15, you're 22, you're 23, you're trying to fit into Australian culture, you're trying to be white. I've got a Sean Christie Davis, my name, I'm pretty lucky. And my mum's like, you're Sri Lankan and you're not special. You're lucky. You're lucky to be born here. You're lucky to have the opportunities. You're lucky to go to school. You're lucky to be in this country and experience what Australia has to offer. Like, don't be egotistical about it, but also recognize that. And it never really hit me. It never did. I'm like, well, this is what I've got. Like, you know, oh, I can work at the banks. I can do this. I can drive cars. Like, whatever. And then I went back and it rocked me.
How?
It rocked me.
In what way?
So I remember going to the shop in Colombo on Gore Fort Road, the ultimate tailor. Go to this store and a tailored suit was $60 Australian from one of the finest tailors in the country. Pure wool suits, gorgeous. And at the time I was a suit, right? So I walk in there and you're getting fitted and you're getting tailored. You've got your hands out and there's three of them. There's three young, they must be 15, 16, but I would have not been that much older than them. And I'm getting measured up. And do you know, when you go to Asia, you're like, oh, it's so cheap. Let's buy like 3,000 suits, you know? So we're buying like 4 or 5 suits, shirts, this, that. And we're just walking through like, yep, cool, we'll grab that, grab that, grab that. And they look at you because for them, like, that's a lot of money. There's three of us, we'd probably drop $1,000, which a normal like suit in Australia would cost you $1,000. So we're like, buying all this stuff and they like looking at you like you're a rock star and that's so uncomfortable.
You know you're not a rock star.
You know you're not a rock star, but but the difference realistically is there is nothing that separated
myself from those young boys at that stage, besides winning a birth lottery that I did not enter and being born in the luckiest country in the world.
So do they see you as like a rich foreigner?
They see me as a rich foreigner. I'm not Sri Lankan, right? And they go, where from? Where from? I'm like, Australia. And they're like, oh, Australia. Wow. And it's the most uncomfortable feeling because, dude, I am you. I am you. I was born somewhere else, but my whole world would have been you. If I was here, I would be you. I did nothing to deserve the opportunities I got. And I look at them and I'm like, if you had those opportunities, where would you be in life? And that sat with me and it built this level of, for a long time, guilt. I was so guilty. I felt so bad. I didn't know what to do with it. I was so undeserving of where I was and I didn't know how to deal with it at that point.
So you left the world of finance?
Left, yeah.
But
yeah.
Maybe you were always going to leave. Maybe in your mind you'd already made up, I'm just hypothesizing here, but yeah. Maybe in your own mind you'd already made up, I'm not that cynical. I'm not in that world mentally and emotionally.
Yeah, exactly. It was a combination of so many things. It was that trip that really got to me. It was seeing my mum happy and seeing myself unhappy. I was unhappy. I was an unhappy person going every day, chasing something that seemed so futile to me and going unsatisfied home. There's bound to be more than this.
So what did you do?
Firstly, I went to the UK and spent a bit of time over there and worked on a big project with the NHS, which was great. And then I returned to Australia and that was that real moment where I'm like, okay, there's got to be more to life. And I started to look for a job which gave me purpose and meaning. And I stumbled upon this role, which was vague job description. Like, do you want to be part of something? You know, I'm like, yeah, I do want to be part of something. And I actually went, it was...
But that was it?
No, I think it had a little bit more. It was like something about like utilizing health as a way to kind of change conversations. Well, two of my best mates, unfortunately, had passed away from cancer at that point as well. So I'd lost mates, my best friend and my cousin to cancer. And, you know, health was a very interesting thing for me as well. So like, how can we change the conversation around death? How can we change the conversation around a few things? And I saw this and I went, well, maybe there's something here. And it was a little interview around the corner from the ABC with this gentleman. And this dude, I'm like, hey, mate. He's like, hi, I'm Norman Swan. I'm like, wow, you got a very nice voice.
The Norman Swan.
Right,
Dr. Norman Swan. Yeah. The ABC's Norman Swan.
Yeah, I didn't know who he was at the time. He was charismatic. He was intelligent. He was a smart dude. And he started telling me about his vision, which was, I'm going to put TV screens right before people go see a doctor. And they can therefore go have a better conversation with their GP. They can therefore go and ask intelligent questions. They can get better health outcomes. And I went, that's really, really smart. I mean, right? So he's like, can you go build this network and find customers and do the things and set it up? I'm like, yeah, cool. Like, yeah, let's do this. So I remember getting our very first customer down in Canberra and starting to build this network of TV screens out into GP centres. And by the time I left 5 years later, it was in 70% of Australian people. Incredible journey. But I had a conversation with someone, and that was Dr. Sam Prince, who is the guy who started Zambero, One Disease, a whole heap of restaurants. And I was at this weird place where I'm like, I've got to do stuff for Sri Lanka. And he's like, can you look at what Australia goes through? This is your country as well. And he was setting up One Disease at the time around Indigenous health and working in Northern Territory. And it kind of got me thinking. And then I went to Redfern Aboriginal Medical Service. I met this incredible practice manager called Karen Silver. She still remember this. I still remember walking in there and sitting there. And I said, oh, look, we've got this thing. It's a TV screen. It's great. You know, you can send messages to your customers right before they go in or they can have a better conversation. And she's like, I love Norman. Norman's great. But Norman's white. What about black people on our screens? And then I started to research the narrative. I started to research what we were saying to Indigenous communities. And the narrative was, you are 16 times more likely to die. You are 20 times more likely to be negative, 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 white person saying negative things. And I went, that's not good. So I worked for this project on many years on the side and everyone kind of knew that I was doing it, but no one really wanted to say that we were doing it because it was not part of the job at the time. I'm doing this on my own time. I'm setting this up. I don't care. I'll do all my job that I have to do. But during my time
at nights or wherever, I will start to work on this channel. So started to build it. Then we met the National Aboriginal Centre of Community Health Organisation. And then I met Pat Turner, who set up NITV. Then I worked with an incredible Indigenous advisory panel, which Norman got together. And then we started to build something magical. I went to every single state and territory in Australia and started to get support from everybody and built something that's called the Aboriginal Health Television Network.
And what does that do for Aboriginal people?
So it allows Aboriginal people to localize content for that specific area in language. So it's to keep language alive, but it was also to get representation from their people on their screen so that it was their stories being told.
And this is being broadcast or is it being screened in the GP's office?
It's being screened in the GP's office. And they're getting Aboriginal health workers, culturally appropriate care. Why can't they own their journey?
And how about you? Were you welcomed into that world?
They were so hospitable. They were so lovely. So I was really lucky to have the trust of some of the elders and the decision makers. But it took 3 to 5 years to build this, to get it approved, to get everybody on board. It was a long project. It was challenging. It was complex, but I knew it was the right thing. I just fundamentally knew it was the right thing. So I backed it and I believed in it. And then the Minister Wyatt, who was the Indigenous minister at the time.
Indigenous himself too, because it's Ken Wyatt.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And he called and said, you've got the money. It's going ahead. Like years of work, like years of going around and believing it when people said it won't be possible and people said no. It was this victory, which lasted about 10 minutes and then I resigned. I resigned because I'm not Indigenous. I resigned because it's not my channel anymore. So I resigned because it needed to have First Nations communities run that channel, and we hired one of the most incredible young men who's still there today. He lives and breathes it. And I was lucky enough to be able to hand that over to him and say, now it's yours.
So with better information at the point of entry into the medical system, you get a better conversation with the doctor, you're more likely to get a better diagnosis, you're getting preventive health measures being taken.
Exactly. But the biggest benefit to me was the keeping the language alive and also that representation of local people talking about it to each other, surgeons all the way through to Aboriginal health workers on the screens. You can't be what you can't see. And if people wanted to go, I want to be a doctor, hey, here's some Indigenous doctors talking to you. How inspiring for the younger generation to know they can get there. And that was the joy for me.
So you've done it. You've done this thing. Then you open a restaurant. That's a bit of a sideways turn, I would have thought. Why a restaurant, Sean?
I remember Norman telling me, like, when I resigned, he's like, mate, where can you go from here? It was an incredible journey. He's like, mate, where are you going?
I'm ready to propose you for Secretary General of the United Nations at this point, Sean. But you're not doing that. You decided to open a restaurant, but a special restaurant.
Yeah. I then went back to the moment, the moment that stands out in my mind, the Taylor moment. It was a combination of not fitting in, being angry, being upset, but I had belief in myself for the first time. I'm like, I can do something. I can do something that was going to change the world. I can do something big. So I started to work on who am I and therefore who is so many people. My story is not very unique. I represent thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of youth whose parents left the country or they left the country at a young age and grew up here with guilt for what goes back on back home and war zones and conflict and famine and things, and then to be in a land of abundance and greatness, and you open a tap and there's running water that you can drink. This Australia is amazing. And then I thought about racism and how did I get to overcome racism? And that was through food. It was through food. I go back to those days of like Women's Weekly and fusion food, or my mum cooking for my friends and them accepting my mum, like my mum had an accent. My mum smelled like curry sometimes when she'd pick me up. And I remember this moment where I would throw sandwiches in the bin because I was embarrassed. And then I went, no, I'm going to own my journey.
Sorry, I have to ask, what was in those sandwiches?
The dal. Yeah, dal, was something that I was embarrassed about. It smelled. No one else had that. We had chicken strip rolls at the canteen and people brought Devon and tomato sauce sandwiches. That's what I was going up against and I chose that.
I'm just remembering them in a hot lunchbox on a hot day. They don't smell too good when you pop the lid on those things.
Exactly. I wanted to own that and I wanted to be proud of my mum. I wanted to be proud of who I was. So when I thought about like the restaurant, it was that first generation story. It was
who are we? Who? It doesn't matter if it's myself as a, you know, Australian-born Sri Lankan or an Australian-born Lebanese or an Australian-born someone from somewhere else in the world. We're all very similar. Our parents spoke differently. Our parents might have spoken different languages. Our parents might have had different food that we're all embarrassed about. It was a very common story. What is that commonality? But then what is special to all of us? It's our food, right? We're proud of our food. We're proud of our culture. We're proud of our legacies and who we are. So I wanted to lean into that. So what I did was I created a restaurant that had Sri Lankan and Australian influences. This is me. I'm not Sri Lankan. I'm not Australian. I'm neither in both. But here it is. So hip-hop music, fusion food, but then lent into super authenticity at the end. So it was like this, cultural journey where you kind of go, okay, cool. Here's something that you're familiar with. You're familiar with a taco. Here's a taco with Sri Lankan influences. You're familiar with a ceviche. Here's a ceviche. Well, you know, this is all modern Australian food. Here's all these dishes that you know and well, you're comfortable eating. Here's a twist on them that has mustard seeds and cumin and chili powders and chili oils and things like that. We've got this dish which is Saganaki, which has like we make our own cinnamon honey chili oil that goes over the top of it. So I was like, okay, cool. I know that dish, but I wouldn't have thought of it in this way.
But Ben, when you're telling me this, a taco is not from Australia, it's from Mexico. Yeah. Ceviche is what, South American, isn't
South
it?
Peruvian.
South American. Peruvian, right. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So really what you're doing is classically Sri Lankan, which is to bring food from all over the world and mixing it and trying and see what works and presenting a fusion. I mean, isn't Sri Lankan food in essence a fusion food to begin with?
Yeah, exactly. But also like modern Australian cuisine is represented by all over the world. You know, I would hand on heart, been lucky enough to travel to various places. The food in Australia is some of the best in the world.
Oh, without a doubt. I still think you can eat better and more cheaply in Australia than of a range of different foods from all over the world than you can anywhere else in the world.
Yeah, exactly. And as chefs and restaurateurs and people, we've embraced that culture. We've embraced food. We've gone international. We've got fusion restaurants. We've got things, but we've been, okay, cool. Let's take those elements and put into our food. And I think that that's what Australian cuisine has also done, and pushed the envelope and pushed the boundary of food, which is great. So I still think a ceviche is a modern Australian kind of now staple, as is tacos and things like that. But we just kind of went, well, these are what we would see in modern Australian cooking now, and let's do our twist on them.
So having set up this restaurant, this kind of contemporary fusion Sri Lankan place, there was something of you bringing that from a Sri Lankan food from the outer burbs into the inner city, wasn't it? How quickly did it take off?
Day one. It was unbelievable. We opened in November 19 and I had no idea about restaurants. It was my very first foray into the whole hospital. I never worked in hospo. Never ever had a job in it. My mum's like, oh, imagine a line out the door. I'm like, oh, imagine two customers, I'd be happy. Do you know what I mean? Like, who am I going to go start this weird restaurant?
And you got the line out the door?
I got the line out the door. I remember opening on a Saturday lunch. And there was so many people. I'm like, we're going to be booked out on a Saturday lunch. Like, we had wait list. You couldn't get in for weeks and months in advance. It was wild. There was like hundreds of people in this restaurant. It was pumping.
So you have all the problems of success in a way, which are the kind of good problems you want. I mean, now you've got to run this powerhouse restaurant. And the staff is key for you, isn't it? Yep. The staff are people who are seeking asylum in Australia.
Yeah, exactly.
What's the thinking behind that?
The privilege that I had. I went back and I looked at my dad and he couldn't get he couldn't get his qualifications recognised because it was from a different country. I remember sitting in Ubers and talking to Uber drivers and they're like, I'm a doctor. I'm an aeronautical engineer. I'm a this. I'm like, whoa, what do you mean? You're driving me in an Uber? Again, that kind of grappling of who am I to be sitting in the back? You should be here. We're missing talent. We're missing people. We're missing the things that they can bring. And they want to bring it to this country. They love Australia. I'm like, well, if we give them a chance, maybe they can build better lives.
Very often asylum seekers arrive and they're in a strange culture. They've been pulled out of trauma. Mm. They arrive here and what they're missing is whatever community they might have. But if you put them in a restaurant, there's community straight away, isn't there?
Yeah. It was incredible to watch the growth. It was incredible to watch them shine, the confidence build, their language skills build, their happiness build, them getting along with people in the restaurant, other staff members who might be from different countries.
Yeah? Yes, and you've brought this concept of the social restaurant to other kinds of food as well. Tell me about those.
Yeah, so when we shut down, we had to shut down for COVID, and that's when we started to do the meal donation program, which is something that we would donate. We donated 3,000, 5,000, 7,000 meals a week to people across Australia.
How do you afford that?
We didn't. I became bankrupt. I remember like going into Coles and my third credit card being declined. We'd spent money on setting up a restaurant, and then we had to quickly, 3 months into the restaurant, pivot to providing meals. And that's why I've talked so fondly about Karen and the work that she did. She called me and said, "Hey, can you help me?" And I said, "Yeah, I've got food." Someone from Mission Australia called me, a good mate of mine from Mission Australia called me and said, "Hey, can you help?" I'm like, "Yeah, I've got food." And then we just started to bundle up whatever food we had and started to donate it. So we started this huge movement during COVID. So we had to shut down the restaurant, tried to pay for it for a long time. We lasted 4.5 months before we were bankrupt, dead broke. And then one of my friends just gave us some money to keep on going. And then it just kind of escalated from there. So since COVID, that April 2020, we've donated 570,000 meals. We donate 3,000 meals a week to people.
This is quality food.
Yeah, restaurant style. Yeah. The one thing I do, if you're a customer of mine, doesn't matter if you're a customer in one of my restaurants where you're paying $60 all the way through to if you're a customer that pays zero, you're a customer, you're a person, you're a being. You've got the same needs, the same wants, the same desires as everybody else. So you deserve the same food. So I'll give you high quality food. I'll give you the food that you want to eat. Might not be the spicy 13-hour slow-cooked goat curry, but it'll be what you want to eat, and I'll meet you there.
And now post-COVID, you've got a Kabul social, which serves Afghan food, a Kiev social, which is Ukrainian food.
We've taken Ukrainian chefs. We've got one Ukrainian chef and then a whole heap of people who have never, ever worked in hospital. I've got a doctor. I've got economists from one of the central banks. I've got a pilot. I've got a florist. Three people who have never, ever had a job before. You know, two or three strong female chefs who had never really worked in restaurants before either, to be people who go out there and serve Ukrainian food. And that commonality of, I believe in you, you can do this. You may not have had a job before, but you can do this, has created a beautiful, beautiful hospitality group.
You're also running a pop-up kitchen and juvenile detention center as well. So this is all really, really different from what you were doing in the world of finance.
Yep.
I mean, happiness isn't something you can ever chase after, but you can get that contentment you were talking about, can you?
Yep.
Do you feel more contentment, or are you still burning? What's going on in your mind and in your heart at the moment?
I'm feeling good. I'm watching the team grow, and I think where we've come to is multiple gauges of success. Success is different now. I have a team of 100 staff. 90% of them are from communities that are underrepresented. So that means only 10% of my staff are people that would otherwise easily walk into a job. So that metrics and that number is a statement of success. That means that they're building each other up. That means that the skill levels and the transferable knowledge is coming from people that would have been working otherwise, and they're passing their knowledge. That means that my training's worked well.
And there's a cultural intersection as well.
Yeah, there's people from my production kitchen has Palestine, Somalia, women out of the incarceration system, youth out of the incarceration system, people living with disability, Ukrainians, Afghans, all together in the central kitchen, and then they pass in their knowledge across the group. We're very, very strong women focused, and majority of our workforce is women through whatever barrier, over the age of 55, people seeking asylum or out of the incarceration system. They make up a large proportion of our workforce, and a lot of them are a lot older women. We have grandmas that might not easily enter the workforce, and the reason I've done that is because my mum was 50 something when she started to look for a job. And who would hire her? And not many people would. So I make a very conscious effort to hire around there.
So you are running this Sri Lankan restaurant.
Yep.
And you are operating off your mum's cookbook. Does she have a voice in the dishes? Does she have some input in the quality of the food and the kind of food that's being prepared, Sean?
She will still go in. She'll still train our chefs. She will still be there and eat the food. She's got a great relationship with them. She's a bit embarrassed to go in there, I think. You know,
why?
She was very... You know, she just considers herself a home cook, and to see heaps of people eating her food makes her like she gets nervous. We work on dishes together. We'll go out and eat something, and we'll kind of like, how can we make that into a dish? I think the next thing that she's going to be working on is I want to launch a series with her where she's cooking with my mum, and you get to like cook with my mum. It's very small, intimate groups, and hanging out with my mum and learn how to cook with her. And then launches a mum char series where you get to just play around with
mum char.
Yeah, I think that'll be cool.
Mum char sounds brilliant. It's been brilliant talking with you as well, Sean. I really love this conversation. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Richard. Thanks for having me on.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more Conversations interviews, please go to the website abc.net.au/conversations.